Are Europeans pivoting away from Israel? Aid returning at a trickle on Monday into Gaza after a two-month blockade. But troops are on the move, and the bombing continues, an average of dozens killed a day in the past week. Israel's prime minister talking up what might sound like a permanent reoccupation of the Gaza Strip. This collective punishment of 2 million civilians, many, says the UN, on the brink of starvation, is exactly the sort of overreaction that Hamas wanted when it perpetrated the worst terror attack in Israel's history more than 18 months ago. At the time, allies insisted on Israel's right to respond. But now, even nations with historical reasons for giving the Jewish state a wide berth are critical. The likes even of Italy, the Netherlands, Germany, and the UK, which has just summoned Israel's ambassador while suspending free trade talks. It signed a communique with Canada and France, which may recognize a Palestinian state next month. We'll ask how far the pivot's gone since October 7th. What sort of future for Palestinians and for Israelis? Today in the France 24 debate, are we witnessing a tipping point for Israel's European allies? With us, the co-chairs of the peace-building advocacy group, A Land for All. Her columns appear in the Israeli daily newspaper, Haaretz, political analyst Dalia Scheindlin. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
He's a past legal advisor to Palestinian negotiating teams and talks with Israel. Omar Dajani, Palestinian-American professor of law at the University of the Pacific in California.
That's right.
Thank you for joining us as well. Journalist Gil Mihaly, editor-in-chief of news publication Revue Conflit. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Before we go to our panel, let's go to the Cannes Film Festival in full swing and the film that sparked an open letter by famous filmmakers and actors. Sepideh Farsi's Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk, the Iranian-born filmmaker, the international press, prevented from entering the Gaza Strip. Instead, conversing by smartphone with a 25-year-old photojournalist, Fatma Hassona. Hassona killed in an Israeli airstrike on April the 16th, 2 days after the film was selected for Cannes.
Where are you now?
I'm in North Gaza. This is my neighborhood. No one lived here, or there. There's no one.
When the war started on October 7th, I was traveling around the world, presenting my last film that talks about a war I've personally experienced as a teenager in Iran. I decided to go to Cairo in order to cross through Rafah, but I couldn't because all the roads to Gaza were blocked. Instead, I started filming Palestinian refugees who were just arriving from Gaza. Through one of them, I came to know Fatem.
Photographer.
Yes, I saw your photos.
Meeting her was like a mirror held in front of me that made me realize how much both our lives are conditioned by walls and wars.
You have many options to die here in South Gaza. You can die by bombing or fear, starvation.
Each of our conversations could be the last one, as Israeli bombs fall everywhere in Gaza all the time.
I was so...
Yeah, me too.
So every time we connect and I can see her face, it feels like a miracle.
Sepideh Farsi joins us from the Cannes Film Festival, real life has caught up with the film that's in presentation, your documentary, what with the news cycle being so tied to this tragic story that unfolded, a personal tale. And the fact that it is a personal tale really resonating, it seems.
Yes, it does. This is exactly what I tried to do when I started this project. Within the first months of the war, after the October 7th attacks, I realized that there was a big piece in this puzzle that was missing. The Palestinians' voice from inside Gaza was missing for me. And people were talking about them from different points of view, but they were not there. They were just figures and statistics. So I tried to break that for my own need, first of all, as a person and as a filmmaker, to go there and to get that voice. And because I was blocked, and miraculously by meeting Fatem through a friend online, this project started, and it was a lifeline that was held for a full year until it broke because of that Israeli missile attack.
Yeah, and you're saying, you said in an interview, there's suspicions the missile attack may have been deliberate?
Well, Forensic Architecture did conducted a report on it. They did ballistic studies, and based on the proofs that they had, it was a clear targeted attack operated by precision missiles, two missiles that were launched by drone on her house. So it apparently is very similar to other attacks that against other journalists in Lebanon and in Gaza. So that is the conclusion of the Forensic Architecture report.
Sepideh Farsi, you're in Cannes, where there's parties and it's glitter. Getting the world's attention, just like getting the world's attention when there was the Women, Life, Freedom movement taking place over months inside of Iran. How difficult is it?
I don't know. It is very difficult. And yet there's, I think, an acute need for many people to talk about this. And it's growing. I observe it more and more. I walk on the Croisette, and people come and hug me and cry. Those who've seen the film or those who've read the articles and haven't yet seen the film or just have heard me speaking about this. I have a feeling there's a deep wound. First of all, because, it started with the attacks of 7th October. But it wasn't then only that. It's all that has been unfolding. And it's the incapacity of our societies in the Western world, at least, to talk about it. You know, we've been hiding it. We've been closing doors, pushing people, not allowing them to talk, to rally, to take positions. And it's been hurting a lot. And now it's very acutely, I mean, the genocide is in course of progress, and we need to do something. So I have a feeling it's time to do something, and there's a great need to talk about it within ourselves and with the Palestinians and with the Israelis, all of us together, to stop these massacres.
There's been plenty of talk here in France, Sepideh. We've had rallies for both sides, pro-Palestinian and supporting the Israeli side ever since October the 7th. When you say that there hasn't been much talk about it, what do you mean?
Well, there have been many cancellations. I'm sure you're aware of it. I'm talking about, rallies there have been, but many rallies have been attacked. Many have been canceled. We have like this Urgence Palestine, for instance, dissolution. Why? What is this, you know? For instance, I mean, this is just an example. There are rallies, not that there are not, but there are also resistance about when you're talking about this issue. This is recent. What we're talking about now is opening up recently. It wasn't this way for the past year and a half. You know, this is the recent months only that it's really opening up into something which is still not there exactly, because we are still looking for words, how to address it, how to talk about it, which terms to use or not to use. There's a lot of, how would I say, frilosité is the word in French. I mean, shyness. Yes. In addressing the issue, and I think it's time to name things and to move forward to stop it.
Sepideh Farsi, many thanks. When will you know, because your film has been selected for one of the competitions at Cannes, when will you know, when is awards night?
It is the documentary award, L'Oeil d'Or, The Golden Eye, and it'll be on Friday noon.
All right, we'll definitely watching out for it. Many thanks for joining us here in the France 24 debate.
I'm sorry, but I think it's outrageous. Since 1982, the war in Lebanon, we are talking about the Palestinians constantly. There is criticism of Israel everywhere and constantly, especially in Western media, saying that it only started recently, that there is resistance, is outrageous. You can say anything you want about Israel. But since at least the Lebanon war in the summer of 82...
You're talking about here in France?
Everywhere.
Okay.
All over the planet, Israel is guilty and the Palestinians are victims. Israel is committing war crimes. We forgot 82, 83, what happened in Lebanon and how it was covered by the world news and how it was. What were the reactions among world public opinions. I'm saying that we discovered today that they were silenced and at last we can talk about something is outrageous. Sorry. Now we can talk about real things.
Oh, Dalia Shannon, let me ask you, inside of Israel, what's the conversation when it comes to, again, what's happened in the last week with dozens killed in Gaza every day?
Well, remember that the government basically announced about 2 weeks ago that it has a plan for an expanded war in which it intends to take over Gaza and ultimately bring it under Israeli control. It talked about specific territories within Gaza, and the government specifically said that part of that plan is to encourage Gazans to leave. So first of all, let's start with what the government is saying. In terms of the conversation among the public, honestly, the public is completely consumed by the aim of getting the hostages released. And for that aim, we know from consistent survey research that between 60% and 70%, up to 73% of the Israeli public would prefer to end the war in order to get the hostages released. So this is the conversation. There is a majority of Israelis who are extremely angry at the government for expanding the war at what they see as the expense of the hostages' lives. I have to say, and I think it's, you know, a deep moral stain, that the conversation is not about the casualties in Gaza, which have reached, frankly, closer to 100
because
a day.
When I look at on social media, the timelines are filled with images of Gaza every day. It's painful to watch. Are those the same images that the average citizen inside of Israel is seeing on Instagram, on TikTok?
You know, all the information is available. Any Israeli who wants to see what's going on in Gaza has that information. Every Israeli has a smartphone. We have very high cell phone and smartphone penetration rate. So they can see it if they want to. I think that we shouldn't overstate social media. What it has done is make a lot of information accessible, but also expanded the opportunity for people to silo themselves within their own preferred forms of information. And that, of course, generates an algorithm that shows them what they want to see. And so there are those who choose not to see it. And we also should admit that there are those who choose to see it and they're not unhappy about it. That does characterize a part of the population as well.
Omar Dajani, let me ask the American side of you about what it's like on campus these days, because we have seen a lot of coverage of what happened last spring. What about now? Is everybody in their silo, as Dalia puts it?
I think to some extent, but I think what's really striking on campuses is that over the last year, because of very significant suppression of campus protests regarding Gaza from university administrations, and even more recently from the government, from the Trump administration, there was a period during which students were afraid. Students were afraid of being expelled. Some students afraid, of course, of being deported. And there was a bit of a silencing of dissent. And what's striking is that over the last few weeks, that's changed. We see American students engaging in a hunger strike to try to bring attention to the deprivation that Palestinians are suffering right now. You see them in all sorts of different spaces, TikTok, in sit-ins on their own campuses, and in demonstrations to government saying, we can't stand it anymore. We're going insane watching this daily grind of violence. And I think governments are starting to take notice. Certainly members of Congress are.
All right. We're seeing that the first aid truck since March the 2nd entered the Gaza Strip on Monday. At a trickle, the UN says it has not heard of trucks entering this Tuesday, although the day's not over yet. We've had in the last hour the Israeli prime minister ordering the return of the delegation holding ceasefire talks from Qatar, and with the army stepping up a ground offensive, EU foreign ministers huddling in Brussels have just announced they're going to review association with Israel. So far, it's largely a symbolic step. The UK, though, firing first with sanctions against settlers and the suspension of trade talks. Emerald Maxwell has more.
It's an unprecedented wave of pressure on Israel as it renews its offensive on Gaza. A number of its allies are no longer holding back on openly criticizing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
And I want to put on record today that we're horrified by the escalation from Israel. The recent announcement that Israel will allow a basic quantity of food into Gaza is totally and utterly inadequate. So we must coordinate our response, because this war has gone on for far too long.
The UK, together with France and Canada, have released a strongly worded joint statement criticising Israel's ramping up of military operations and have even threatened consequences if aid delivery to the enclave continues to be impeded.
The blind violence and blockade of humanitarian aid by the Israeli government have turned Gaza into a place of death. The Netherlands has proposed that the association agreement between the European Union and Israel be re-examined. We have supported this initiative.
The long-standing agreement could be suspended if Israel was found to be reneging on its clauses related to human rights. That would have trade implications. Separately, the UK has paused its free trade agreement negotiations with Israel and summoned the Israeli ambassador. Israel was quick to hit back, saying external pressure will not divert it from its path. On Monday, the Israeli Prime Minister also said that the leaders of London, Ottawa and Paris were offering Hamas a huge prize by asking Israel to end the war and demanding a Palestinian state. French President Emmanuel Macron has suggested that depending on certain conditions, France could join 148 other countries in recognizing a Palestinian state at a UN meeting in June, putting pressure on other G7 states to follow suit.
Yeah, and again, Gil Mihaly, there's this motion that was tabled in Brussels. It was tabled by the Netherlands, one of Israel's most steadfast allies. What does that tell you?
Well, I think the situation is very complicated. There's a big pressure. We saw it before. It's a roller coaster. During the ceasefire, people stopped talking about Gaza. They forgot about it. Now, since there are, again, fresh images, then everyone is on the subject again, and they are pushing their governments to do it. But after October 7th, we were at least two or three times in the same conversation, huge pressure on Israel. It was worse because the Americans started putting limits on arms shift to Israel, which was impeding the war effort. So the situation is very grave. We've seen moments of this gravity before. Israel.
This isn't the worst.
It's not the worst, but it doesn't mean it's good. And you know, repeating worse risk finally breaking something. It's really a very, very bad dynamic. I know that in the American public, the support for Israel is declining, and this is a strategic asset. Israel is in very, very hard position, very, very difficult position on both sides, because the strategy from 2006 in Lebanon facing Hezbollah and Hamas was that an enemy that is such imbricated in such a way, integrated such a way with the population, it'll be a massacre if there will be a war. So you need to do everything in order to avoid war. So Israel, through Qatar, paid Hamas, bribed them. They did all kind of things to avoid war. In 2014, during the summer war, Netanyahu even leaked to the press information about the casualties the army will support in an operation like what we see. He wanted to avoid it at all price because he knew what will happen.
But
Gil, and then it blew up.
In the days after October the 7th, on this very set, you yourself said that if you flatten the Gaza Strip, it's not going to solve the problem because you can't kill an idea.
Yes.
And that's what Benjamin Netanyahu seems to be doing right now.
No. He's kicking the can, and he knows. I mean, Netanyahu's career is you wake up in the morning, you survive to the evening. And then you survive to the morning, and then you're 16 years in office, and you went through Obama. When Obama was elected, Netanyahu will not hold 6 months. I mean, with settlements, he survived Obama, he survived Biden. The situation maybe is difficult in Europe, but just imagine that.
So he's managing a forever war.
He's managing an impossible situation. Since 1949, no one wants a Palestinian state. It's a mortal danger for Jordan. The Egyptians don't want it because it's the Muslim Brotherhood. So what they have is someone to take care of the Palestinians, and at the same time they can shout at him because he's genociding the Palestinians. It's a free ride. So there are all the public opinions in the Arab states, but MBS doesn't care about the Palestinians. The Lebanese still remember that they sabotaged the state. I mean, apart that what we're seeing and what we are reacting to are
immense
human tragedies. But just like Angela Merkel did with the Palestinian girl that said, "Why can't I live like my German friends in Germany?" And she said, because there's something which is called the moral of responsibility. If I give you a visa, I'll have to give a visa to 1 million people. And this is something that Germany cannot hold. So facing an individual tragedy, all we want to do is just to hug the person and say, what we can do for you. But when there is a situation like this, you ask yourself different questions. You say, how can I avoid the next war? I mean, stopping the Israeli argument today, and we can argue about it, is that stopping the war today, we start the countdown for the next October 7th, but because we know what Hezbollah or Hamas do when you don't mourn alone regularly.
So Dalia Shineland,
I would like to respond to a couple of points.
Yeah.
I think for one thing, we need to be clear about the Biden administration, because in no way did the Biden administration hamper the fighting. In fact, it gave unprecedented levels of military, financial, and political support. And it delayed one weapons shipment well into the war that had very little effect on Israel's policies, as we see now. But the other point that I want to respond to is the idea that Netanyahu was trying to stave off war and escalation by funding Hamas. That's not a way to avoid war. Hamas, of course, armed itself with Qatari money. And if you want to stave off conflict and if you want to de-escalate, there's only one way to do it. That's a comprehensive political resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and an end of occupation. Forever wars lead to more wars. Wars come in cycles. That's why we've had an accelerating cycle of wars during the entire phase when the Israeli government said it was managing the conflict. 2008-09, 2012, 2014, 2021, I could go on, and it will go on unless we reach comprehensive political resolution.
So, Omar Dajani, tell us about what a land for all does, because you're trying to find another solution rather than playing whack-a-mole.
Absolutely. And so a land for all, at the end of the day, is a two-state solution. What we're advocating for is what the international community has long advocated for in one respect. A Palestinian state is established alongside Israel with a border based on the June 4th, 1967 line. But where we're different is that we understand that one of the major impediments to achieving that two-state solution is the fact that more than 700,000 Israeli settlers currently reside in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. And that presents a real challenge. And so what we have undertaken to do is to create a vision that is responsive to that challenge. How? By changing not where the border is, but instead what kind of border it is. We embrace a framework of freedom of movement and freedom of residence for all Palestinians and all Israelis, gradually implemented over time to ensure that both peoples have security. And through that means, we find solutions to the problem of settlements. The settlers could become permanent residents of the state of Palestine. We have a solution to the problem of Palestinian refugees who seek a right of return to Israel and could become permanent residents of the state of Israel without upsetting the fact that Israel would remain have a democratic majority of Jews, and we have a solution to the problem of how to divide Jerusalem. Instead of dividing a city that is indivisible, we share it within a regime of partnership.
How come this hasn't been done before?
It's a great idea.
It was proposed, actually, before. I mean, it was the basis for
1937, actually.
It was the basis for the 1947 partition plan. It is something that should be advocated at this juncture. I think the reason it hasn't been done before is that during the Oslo process, a different idea dominated. The idea was...
This was after 1992.
Yeah, thanks very much. So from 1993 onwards, the peace process that was inaugurated by Bill Clinton embraced a different idea, and that was that the way to achieve peace was by segregating Jews from Palestinians. Us here, them there, is a famous campaign slogan, put it at the time. And we say, you know what? Both peoples should have self-determination. Both peoples should have a state. But these two states need to be not only adjacent to each other, but intertwined in a way that our lives already are.
So I have just a question. Why wasn't the Palestinian state created between 49 and 67 when Jordan occupied and annexed the West Bank, and the Egyptians controlled Gaza? And why didn't Sadat demand Gaza in order to give it to the Palestinians, just like he demanded a beach resort near Eilat, and he was ready to give the peace away in order to have 500 meters of a beach resort?
You know, I'm not sure if that's the question we need to be asking right now. What we do know is that when we have final status peace agreements with Israel's neighbors, who were their bitterest enemies for the first 30 years of its existence, they have become the most stable allies, hot or cold, peace. But Jordan and Egypt have full peace agreements with Israel. Israel made concessions, and those peace agreements have held. You said before that nobody wants a Palestinian state. I think there are two people who want a Palestinian state, Palestinians. And I would like to say, as an Israeli, I think that the non-state situation is the most fertile possible ground for non-state actors to foment violence. The deterioration of the quality of life has been severe throughout the phase when the conflict was being managed and the separation and segregation policy was implemented most severely against Gaza. And that's part of what led to the current situation. We want to break that paradigm by saying we can have two states. They are already fundamentally interdependent. You can't rip the populations apart. We need a political framework to express that.
And so if I could add just one thing on that front, I'm sorry, Gil. You know, instead of looking back towards the past, we feel that it's crucial to look toward the future. There are 7 million Palestinians, 7 million Jews in this tiny land that we share. And what our task is right now is to figure out not how to push each other out, but how to share it equitably in a situation where neither side is dominating the other. That's what we owe our children and grandchildren. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
Sure,
at this juncture.
It's a noble cause. The question that Israelis ask themselves is, in the case of a solution based on a compromise, Palestinians will have a homeland, but they will not have their homes. So the question is whether the key to a house somewhere could be exchanged against a passport, meaning that if their political collective consciousness can move from property, a house and a tree, to sovereignty, being a citizen of a state. The Israeli experience is the answer is no. And that as soon as Israel withdraws from a piece of land, those who said we want Jaffa, we want Haifa, or like Hamas, we don't want the Jews anymore, will start rearming, and they will start. And we know that there is.
And that works both ways, by the way, because you have all the West Bank settlers who've just come under sanctions right now. You have radicals on both sides.
You're right. If we ignore the question that I asked before. Why wasn't there a state in 67? So no six days war, and no settlers. Because the Jordanians and the Egyptians, the idea to have a Palestinian state was outrageous for them. And when Israel occupied in 67, King Hussein asked the Israelis, do whatever you want, just don't make a Palestinian state. It's the end of the Hashemite dynasty.
I still don't understand why we keep going back to this idea that Israel withdrawing from territory means that there's some danger at the end of it. Israel withdrew from the Sinai, gave it back to Egypt in a full peace agreement with a full stable state. And it has a very stable relationship with the country that was its biggest enemy. Israel, on the other hand, didn't actually withdraw or give anything remotely like sovereignty or statehood to the Palestinians since 1993 to the present. Even Gaza, where it did actually dismantle settlements in 2005, Israel retained near hermetic control over Gaza almost the entire time, over its land and sea borders, airspace, electromagnetic field. Maybe if you actually think about land for peace in the sense of a full peace agreement with a state, you'll reach a different solution based on the precedent that we've seen that history has shown us.
And you think like a lawyer, not like a historian.
I think like an Israeli who lives there.
Yeah. Well,
and I see, and I also think like an Israeli who's been working on this issue pretty much for the last 26 years when I was doing public opinion research for the negotiations of the Camp David two-state negotiations in the year 2000. I've been doing public opinion research on the issue ever since. And I've also been examining as a political scientist every possible solution that has failed, that has not failed, comparative examples. I don't think we have a precedent for showing that what we're doing now, what has been happening for the last 15 years, would lead to anything other than further escalation.
All right, let me put that question, though, Omar Dajani, to you. Again, how do you deal with the radicals on both sides in your plan?
So the starting point is you...
Because we've done, just to interrupt, sorry, we've done so many debates here where one person can just blow up the conversation just with one buzzword like Sabra and Shatila. Or can start. You just use these words that they know the other side. That ends the conversation and everybody becomes polarized.
So I there are so many polarizing words. I think when we try to figure out how to reduce polarization and extremism in Israel-Palestine, a starting point on the Palestinian side is to give Palestinians their rights. When we look at the Palestinian Authority, its legitimacy is very low right now. Palestinians look at it and they see a government that has failed to achieve what they hoped it would achieve at the outset. And the main problem that they have is not corruption, though that's an issue. The main problem that they have is that over these last 30 years, the Palestinian Authority has failed to deliver them freedom, failed to deliver them an end to checkpoints, the ability to move around their own country in freedom, to travel and get an education, to be able to trade easily and freely with people in their country and outside of it. And I have a firm conviction, based on having lived there, based on having spent time trying to negotiate a way past this impasse, that the best way for us to empower moderates in Israel-Palestine is to create a framework that people can believe in, a framework that provides benefits for both sides.
So do you need then an outside actor to mediate for all of this, or can it just be done
amongst
yourselves?
Look, I think that it is really important for there to be a multilateral process in which a range of international actors are involved, and that's in part because there is a really huge power disparity between Israel and the Palestinians, economically, militarily, and in terms, as Dalia pointed out, of political influence globally. And so there is a need for international intervention.
So who do you turn to in 2025?
In this context right now, I think it's got to be a coalition. I think it's great that Europeans and Canadians are taking action. I think it's important for the United States to get into the mix. If I think the Trump administration is, at this juncture, hard to predict, but to say the least.
We all agree on that.
Yeah, exactly. But is doing interesting things, and doing interesting things in part because at least some people in the administration perceive an interest in moving forward toward peace. I mean, it's not an accident that the Trump administration has been focused on the Saudi horizon, and that is in part because of the economic relationships between
the United States.
I thought
because he's playing golf and they told him it's the Gulf states.
It's because they see Saudi Arabia in part as a stabilizing force in the region. And whatever one thinks about Saudi Arabia in a broader sense, I think it has played that role. And I think that they look at the Israeli government, the Netanyahu government, and they see an actor that is chaos-making rather than stabilizing the region. And that, I think, is one of the things they're really concerned about.
That handshake last week between Donald Trump and Syria's new strongman, Ahmad al-Shara, is that part of the reason why Benjamin Netanyahu has been doubling down this past week with these airstrikes inside of Gaza?
No, I don't think so. Well, Trump is, you know, it's difficult to, you know, he can say that it's terrible that what's happening in Gaza. He can say it in the morning, and everyone thinks that he flipped and he's going to pressure Israel. And then in the afternoon, he's talking about Libya, about project of moving 1 million people to Libya. And the next morning, he will see something on his feed. He will see children with queuing for food. So we said we have to do something about it. And we really don't know. It's not a huge success in the Ukraine. It's not a huge success with Iran, with Iran too. I mean, what is the strategy? He is a very unpredictable actor. But
my question was more about the Israeli reaction handshake.
The Israeli reaction is, as I said before, the current government and an important part of the Israeli public, those who vote, believe that there is no possible solution with actors like Hamas or Hezbollah. And globally, the idea is the Lebanese model. Israel eliminates the radical actor, and if there is a political actor that can profit from this maneuvering space, then something will be built. So in Lebanon, it didn't fail yet. It could succeed. And there is a very strange, what's happening in Lebanon is exactly what Israel wants for Gaza. A ceasefire with Israel as the lifeguard. I mean, it's Israel that decides.
But here we're talking about Syria, where it's a whole different story. I mean, Donald Trump is lifting sanctions.
Yes. Why? Why is Iran ready to talk? Because Israel bombed its anti-air defenses. Because Israel eliminated Hezbollah. Because Israel eliminated Hamas. And because of what happened in Lebanon, Syria just collapsed. So this is what Israel gave the region. And since Netanyahu has a very short, his policies is, as I said before, surviving from morning to evening and from evening to morning, he cannot cash out on this. So the everyone can be happy that he is weakening Iran, and at the same time, instead of paying him, they're kicking him in the ass. So they're enjoying. They profit from all.
Tyler Shaman.
I think what the Israeli public is seeing, what they're really seeing now is a series of snubs to Netanyahu. They're seeing that Trump snubbed him in numerous ways on Syria, on Saudi Arabia, on negotiating with Hamas, on Iran. This goes on, and then now they're seeing this wave of signals that are very negative coming out of Europe. And I think the Israeli public, yes, they are extremely skeptical of peace. And yes, they believe that Israel had a huge role in reshaping the Middle East. But I also think that what we see is that there's an opportunity that does involve this kind of regional cooperation. All of the surveys I've been conducting and other colleagues of mine have been conducting show very consistently that when Israelis think there is a partnership, potential for normalization in the Middle East, they are willing to practically double their support for a Palestinian state. And that's where what we haven't seen so far is that the Emirates didn't actually demand any movement on a Palestinian state. What we see is that there's more openness to a two-state solution if they think it comes along with these regional alliances. And I want to say one more thing about the Israeli public, because there is flexibility. There is a sense of being deeply despairing of the situation. You had visuals up before showing Israelis holding pictures of hostages and Israelis holding pictures of children in Gaza who've been killed. These are tiny little portions of Israelis, but they are going around the country. They have been joined by more Israelis over the last number of weeks, and they are taking those posters to places like Air Force bases. There are a lot of people saying
lots
privately,
of military who refuse to go to
we are ourselves not happy with this humanitarian situation. They understand where the criticism is coming from. And as you correctly point out, there is a declining draft rate for reservists. So I think there are changes underway. We need to seize the opportunity. That's why we want the plan out there so that it can be discussed by policymakers.
Let's come back to Paris a second. There was that joint communique put out Monday by Canada, France, and the UK. It points to this Arab plan for rebuilding Gaza and looks ahead to next month's UN conference in New York, which is co-hosted by France and Saudi Arabia. In the statement, it says, we affirm the important role of the high-level two-state solution conference at the UN in June in building international consensus around this aim. And they also say they're committed to recognizing a Palestinian state as a contribution to achieving a two-state solution and prepared to work with others to that end. Emmanuel Macron said he may or may not recognize a Palestinian state on June 15th in New York. What would change if France recognized a Palestinian state, if anything?
First of all, it has a huge political importance. It counts. It's an event. It will create a dynamic that is going in the sense of supporting the Palestinians. I hope it will be clear that they are supporting the Palestinian Authority and not trying to salvage Hamas. For the juridic implications, I don't exactly know what it means. They will have rights here and there, but politically, it's a very, very important step.
Omar Tajani?
I think that recognition of a state of Palestine is long overdue. I think that it can play a useful role in this process, but in order for it to be transformative, in order for it to change the situation on the ground, I think it A, needs to be linked to a recognition that the basis for the territorial basis for that Palestinian state will be the June 4th, 1967 line, by pointing to a recognized border that Israel hasn't had through its history and that the Palestinians haven't been able to enjoy either. I think France can help move us in the right direction on that front. I think the other thing that's needed is a process that says, you know what? What's happening in the Gaza Strip, this catastrophe, cannot be ended just through a narrow focus on either humanitarian aid or even reconstruction in the Gaza Strip. It needs to be through a process that links Gaza with the West Bank, that establishes a Palestinian state alongside Israel, and in a framework like the one that we've been proposing at A Land for All that enables both peoples to live alongside each other in peace.
Alongside each other in peace, are the stars aligning? There is this pendulum shift, as Dalia was mentioning earlier, right now in the region. But are people prepared to view things differently? They're kind of gone back into their shell after October 7th and traumatized.
I think that's true. And I think that we're going to need a period of stabilization, but that shouldn't distract us from where we need to go. I think what we've been arguing in part is that for too long we said, well, we'll wait to figure out what the end point of a process is until the populations are ready, until we're just on the verge of achieving it. And I think that strengthened spoilers. It strengthened opponents of peace. What we need to do, if we're serious about getting to that end point, we need to say where we're going. If you want to get somewhere, then be clear about where you want to head.
All right, we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. So much more to talk about. Omar Tajani, Dalia Scheindlin, Gil Mihaly, I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.